Call recording, call recording. 1, 2, 3. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our conference call here. There's about 75 of us. I think most of us are from different companies. As people are logging in, I see additional people coming in. I think it's a good idea for me to go through the conference in the following manner. Let me give you a very short, brief overview of what's going on under the bill that's proposed. Once I have run through the basics, I can then open the call for questions or comments. And if everybody feels that I need to go through more detail into the law, I'll be happy to do that for you. Let me start with just an overview. I've done this before. All these videos are available on our website. If you go to immigration.com and look at the top right there, there's a page that says Immigration Reform 2013. If you click on that page, I know it is not the most elegant design, but we will get the design done by the time we get into the real law. Right now, this is just a bill. And if you click on that page, you'll be able to see all the latest information that I'm sharing with you, as are, I'm sure, a lot of other people. So beginning with the bottom lines, in the H-1 proposed law, there is a severe restrictions on outplacements. This restriction is there on both sides, H-1 as well as L-1. For H-1, if you are an H-1B dependent employer, and dependency begins at 15%. If you have 51 employees, dependency begins at 15%. That means if you have 8 employees on H-1B, you cannot outplace any employee. What does that mean? Outplacement means the definition of the outplacement term is quite vast. It basically says, well, you can't place them somewhere else, and et cetera, et cetera, 2 or 3 different terms. And the last one is, or otherwise contract for the employee services. So basically the idea is, the way I see it, they're pretty much taking away consulting business H-1s. So if you're a consulting business, you need to be very, very concerned, because outplacement will be pretty much impossible. Okay? Then you will also pay, if you are an H-1B dependent, actually it's a little bit more than that. There's a 30 to 50% and 50 to 75% rule. You pay $5,000 to $10,000. Those percentages relate to the number of H-1B, L-1B employees. Okay. If you have 30 to 50%, I think I've got the percentages right. Of course, I've got them written down as we go along. So you pay $5,000 or $10,000, depending upon what percentage of your employees are H-1B, L-1B. Okay. That's per H-1 extra. Everybody who's doing an H-1 has to advertise for 30 days before you even file the papers, before you file the LCA. You have to advertise on a website that the government will provide. Companies who are H-1B dependent will have to advertise, in addition to the 30 days, you'll have to place newspaper ads. So it's almost like doing a mini labor certification. Okay, so you'll be doing a mini labor certification before you even get into the H-1. Next big difference is that all H-1B dependent employers have to pay at least level 2 salaries. There is no level 1 salary. So even if you hire somebody right out of school, you are required to pay them level 2 salary. And you'll be given only 3 levels to choose from. You won't have 4 levels. And the way the salary calculations will be made, the salaries are likely to be $5,000 to $10,000, $15,000 higher than what you were used to, because they've changed the way they will do the calculations. Okay? So the salary given by the Department of Labor itself will be much higher. You have to offer the job to a U.S. worker who's qualified, of course, at the same salary. The investigatory authority of the Department of Labor has been increased considerably. Now they can investigate you without notice if the circumstances so permit. If you have 100 plus employees and you have 15% of them on H-1B, you will be mandatorily audited every year. So every year, by law, Department of Labor will audit 100 plus employee companies, and they will make these reports public. Now, I find that very awkward to deal with. We have done, I was reading a tweet from Marco Rubio, which said we should not leave, this is just about 10 minutes ago, there was a tweet from Marco Rubio that said we should not leave immigration law in the hands of Obama government because they have neglected enforcement. Well, that's just not true. In my practice of the last 20 years, I've got close to 30 years of law practice, but in 20 years of my practice, just taking the last 20 years, 15 years, in the first 15 years, I did a total of maybe 10 or 15 audits and investigations. In the last 5 years, I have participated in over 150 Department of Labor audits, investigations from DHS, State Department investigations, and assisting in criminal defense of white-collar crime imposed upon companies that are supposed to have committed immigration violations. Okay. So 10 to 150, that's a huge amount of increase in audits and investigations. Now, anybody, any one of you who has gone through a Department of Labor audit knows what a pain audits are. Okay? Audits can create such a havoc in ordinary business of the company. It's not something to look forward to, but if you have 100 employees, 100 plus employees, which means 101, and 15% of them are H-1B, L-1B, you're going to be audited on a yearly basis as a matter of routine. And the results of the audits will be posted publicly. A summary. Okay. So Department of Labor can walk in, they can investigate you without notice, and the results will be published. This is a yearly event. The fines for violations have been doubled. They have taken away the exception that used to exist under the prior practice, where if you have committed a technical violation or a violation without any intention, when it's just unintentional, Department of Labor can let it slide. Now there is no such thing. And the period of violations limitations has gone to 24 months from 12 months. Previously, if you ever got a notice from the Department of Labor, it would say, we want to look at XYZ for the last 12 months. Now they'll go to 24 months. Bars from participating in H-1B and green card programs used to be, okay, you know, there's a maximum. Now we begin with a minimum. Minimum bar for violations is 1 year from participating in H-1B and green card programs. And for willful violations, the minimum bar is 2 years. There's no maximum. Okay? In addition to all this, there is a restriction on total number of H-1B, L-1B employers you can hire. And I'm speaking from memory here. I don't have the slides in front of me. I'm speaking from memory. And, of course, if you guys all want, I can go into much greater details after we had a brief discussion. That was the plan. I will just run through the basics and then maybe get into a discussion with everybody. And if you guys want me to address any particular areas of the law, I will. If you folks want me to just go through the whole thing in detail, of course, it's already posted. If you go to our website, and look at the immigration.com homepage. On the top, there is a link to Immigration Reform 2013. Videos are all posted on that page. Okay. That said, so there is a restriction on the total number of H-1B L-1Bs you can hire. And from what I remember, the limit goes like this. In 2015, you cannot have more than 75% on H-1B and L-1B in your company. In 2016, that number drops to 65%. In 2017, it drops to 50%. You are not going to be given additional visas beyond that. Okay. So that's what we are looking at. For the L1, pretty much the same principle follows. The fines go, the filing fees go up to $5,000 to $10,000 depending upon the number of L1B employees you have in your company. And I want to point out here, in the statute, the proposed bill, there are, the, as I read through it, I found something odd that they had used L visas, L1B visas, and just L1 visas. So L, L1B, and L, L1B, L, and L visa. L, L1B, and L1 visas. So it's basically three terms used in different parts of the statute. I'm not sure if there is a difference or these are just typos or if the different groups of legislative drafters worked on these provisions. So hopefully by the time the bill goes through the process of discussions, all these things will be straightened out. Like I said, on the H-1 side, the fees will go up by $5,000 to $10,000 depending upon the number of L1 people you have in your company. So if you are 30 to 50%, I think 30 to 50 is 5,000. If you have 50 to 75% employees on L, you go up to 10,000. There are again severe restrictions on outplacement, just like there are restrictions on the H-1B dependent employers. You cannot outplace. L-1B cannot be outplaced. An outplace definition is quite comprehensive. It includes everything. Outplacement within your own group is allowed. If you have sister company within USA, it will be allowed, but there are certain further restrictions in that. Investigatory authority with Department of Homeland Security is again like on the H-1 side of the Department of Labor. They can just walk into your premises without notice if they want, if circumstances so permit. And for companies with 15% L visas, they'll be 100 plus employees, they'll have to go through mandatory annual audits, and the results of the audits will be made public. Again, the violations limitation period, just like on the H-1B side, is 24 months. The bars, again, minimum of 1 year, willful violation 2 years, you'll be barred from participating in the L program and in the green card program. There's an overall restriction on the number of H-1B, L-1Bs that you can hire. I said, I already mentioned that, I'll repeat it. 2015, that restriction is no more than 75% total in your company. In the year 2016, that drops down to 65%. 2017, it drops down to 50%. So beyond that, they will not issue you H-1Bs or L-1Bs in the year 2017. Both H-1 and L-1 side, there was one thing I noticed, and I don't like this. I know don't like it for the employees, I don't like it for the employers, and I don't like it for the system. What they've done is they have made a statement that if an employer's violations of H-1B or L-1B rules caused an employee damages in wages and or benefits, the employer will be liable to the employee. What that means, to me at least, as a litigator, is that employee can not only complain to the Department of Labor or DHS, but also bring private lawsuit. They could do it under the current scheme of things also, but it's a lot simpler to just go through DHS or Department of Labor. I just don't like the idea of so many lawsuits either threatened or happening from one particular program. it would have been a lot simpler if Department of Labor investigation wrapped up everything. So that's, those are the bottom lines that I saw on H1 and L1 side. There are some two or three other interesting points that I mentioned. This is very important. When they do H1 or L1 calculations, they will not count intended immigrant employees, intending immigrant employees. What does that mean? That means anybody whose I-140 had been approved. So if in your company 10 I-140s have been approved, those employees are not counted towards H1, L1 numbers in dependency, in fees, etc. A little trickier definition is this. In addition to those whose I-140s have been filed, those whose labor certs have been approved or have been pending for 1 year will be exempt only if the employer in the last 12 months has filed I-140s on 90% of the approved form applications. Let me repeat that. If your employee's labor cert has been pending for 1 year or has been approved, they could be intended immigrant and hence not counted only if you, the employer, have shown a record of 90% I-140 filings in your approved form cases in the last 12 months. There's a couple of other small points there, but that's kind of the bottom line. So what do they want us to do? They want us to file green cards as quickly as possible to be exempt from some of these requirements. Can you then outplace an employee if you don't have the 15% number? Actually, the number is a little better for companies below 50 employees, but from 51 employees, the number begins to be 15%. So if you have a number of intended immigrants, then you can place, outplace your employees. But you also have to pay an additional $500 fee for outplacement. Okay. They are giving H-4 employees, H-4 holders work authorization, but only if the H-4 employees or H-1 employees country where they come from give some kind of a similar benefit to work visa holders in that country for U.S. citizens. So if India, for example, has an H-1 type visa and India allows spouse of that visa holder to work, then we will also in the United States give a similar benefit to H-4 holder. Very odd provision. I don't know how it's going to be managed. I don't know how they are going to survey the laws of all the countries involved. But that's how we have it right now. An additional point for university and school council and in-house staff is this. Universities that are for-profit and schools that are for-profit are treated the same as regular employers, except for the quota. I'm sure that will be different. A couple of points that I want to make about the bill itself. Remember, this is just a bill. It's not law yet. So if any of you want to get together and increase public awareness about these matters, you can do that. This is not law yet. The second thing I want you to remember is that by the time the bill becomes law, it could go through many, many different changes. Right now, what is the current state? S-744, the bill that I'm referring to, the bill that was floated by the gang of eight, the eight senators, four from each side of the aisle, that bill is right now sitting before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The Judiciary Committee then sits down and marks the bill and forwards it to full Senate. In the meantime, on the House side, I can never pronounce that name right, Congressman Goodlatte, G-O-O-D-L-A-T-T-E, and Congressman Gowdy are spearheading, both Republicans, one from Virginia, one from South Carolina. Both are South or North Carolina, one of the Carolinas. Both are spearheading of immigration reform. Remember, there is We don't have agreement in the House and the Senate yet about what the bills should hold. Congress is divided on this issue. House of Representatives feels that they want to do piecemeal, small portions, like they have agricultural workers and E-Verify programs being separated out and passed through first. Whereas Senate believes, or at least the Gang of Eight believes, that we should have a uniform reform. Everything should be covered. To me, it looks like in this program to legalize people who are in this country illegally, which is an admirable effort by itself, but they have thrown the H-1B visa program under the bus. They've increased the numbers. The numbers go from 110 to 180,000. 110 minimum, 180 maximum. Numbers can go up and down 10,000 each year based upon an index that which they call high-skilled job demand index. So the numbers can go up and down. Floor is 110, ceiling is 180. That's good. That's a good number, but who's going to use those? They've made it so difficult. This was an outline of what I wanted to speak about. Some of you logged in late. I hope that most of you got a gist of what I'm talking about. Now, folks, if you have any questions, any comments, please press *5 on your phone. Press *5. Any questions, any comments, press *5, and let's talk about this further. My plan was, like I said, I'll just go over the basics and then answer questions if I can. I may not have all the answers. Answer questions on specific areas of the bill as you want. I don't want to go through the detail line by line, section by section, compilation and commentary on the bill. I've already done that. That's on our immigration.com. On the homepage, on the very top, you've got a link to Immigration Reform 2013 page. All the videos, all the latest information will be posted there. And we will improve that page. I promise you right now that page does not look good. I am not very proud of it. But I'm proud of the fact that we're getting the information out. So please press *5 on your phones if you have any questions or comments so far. I hope you all can hear me, and there's only one hand up so far. So you folks must really understand the bill. Okay, that's good to know. Area code 732, I know who you are, please go ahead. Area code 732, go ahead, we can hear you.
Yep, Rajiji, this is Mahesh. Basically, the question I have is that, you know, the H-4 dependence that depending on the country of the passport or origin, what about India? So the India, does they allow for U.S. citizens the work permit? So it's the same thing vice versa or any idea on that?
I don't know, but I'll find out. I'll make a couple of calls to lawyers in India. I have not practiced law, Manishji, in India since the year 1986. 2 years that I practiced law there, I did not run into any immigration issues in those days. I don't even know what the laws were. But I'll have to find that out. That's a good question. I was asked that question last time as well. Folks, let me remind you, this call is being recorded, and it will be made publicly available. So you may want to feel free to conceal your identities and make sure that your comments are such that you don't feel any problem making them public. Okay? So, yeah, Mahesh, if you'll find that out, I'll put that on my things to do list.
Okay, and another question is just when do you expect this bill will be passed and implemented? And if the quota increases, do they accept another round of applications for this quota for February?
So far, this is what it looks like. Nancy Pelosi, who is also a power in the House, she's the House Minority Leader, has said that we will get comprehensive immigration reform passed before we break for summer. So I looked it up. The summer recess of Congress begins on August 5th. So if House leadership is to be believed, they want to get this done by August 5th. Now, the quota, I think they want to begin from fiscal year 2014. It looks unlikely that they'll make more numbers available this year, but you never
know. So 2014, Mr. Ajit, this is the 2014, right? October is 2014.
Did I say 20? It's fiscal year 2014. You're right. This is fiscal year 2014. No, this is 2013.
Yeah, now the October quota will be 2014.
Yeah, they're talking about 2014, 2015, I think. Beginning October 1st of 2014.
Oh, October 1st of 2014, not the year of 2014.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I'm just speaking from memory because this bill is 844 pages long, and I've had the pleasure of going through a lot of it. So I don't remember. I'm just speaking from memory. I think it was October 1st, 2014, fiscal year 2014-2015, I would say. They're not going to do it this year. I don't think so.
Okay, sure.
Let me double check. I can check the law as we are. The number, quota numbers, let me just go over this 1 second. I can look it up first real quickly. I have the bill open in front of me. H-1B employer application, market-based H-1. So this is section 4101. 4101 says, it says the first fiscal year beginning after the date of the enactment. So 2014-2015. So it won't be this fiscal year.
Okay, sure.
Because they said fiscal year beginning after the date of the enactment. So once this law passes, after that, the immediate next fiscal year will begin. Okay? Mahesh, did you have anything else? Oh, I think we lost him. Okay. Let me go on to the next hand. We've got about 4 or 5 people with questions or comments. So in no particular order, I'll just pick up whoever I spot next. Number 2 person, area code 630. Go ahead, please.
Yes, there was an option of outplacement with the $500 fee. Could you please?
That's only available to those companies who are not H-1B dependent.
Okay.
Okay. And remember, when you count dependency, you can count out intending immigrants. So people whose green cards have been filed and have reached a certain stage of maturity, your employees will be counted out.
If an employer is not H-1B dependent or L-1 dependent, then they can place any number of people outside?
They can, as long as by placing that those number of people, they are not exceeding and becoming H-1B dependent. You only have to pay an outplacement fee of $500. You can outplace people, but as you have seen, so far USCIS has created a lot of complications in outplacements, including the employer-employee relationship issue. Remember, an important point to know about this bill is it's an amendment. A lot of these are amendments. So whenever it does not expressly overrule an existing requirement, that requirement is going to stay in the law. Okay?
Okay.
Good luck. Okay, let me go on to the next question. Let's see. All right. I'm actually scrolling through a whole bunch of people. Area code 972, go ahead, please.
Rajiv, what can we do to oppose this bill? That's number one question. Number two, can we open up multiple companies and distribute the employees?
No. Multiple companies will not work because under the bill, the definition of H-1B includes all related and commonly controlled companies. Okay.
Okay.
For commonly controlled company definition, you have to go to Internal Revenue Code. So it refers you to tax laws to say whatever tax laws considered to be commonly controlled, that's what commonly controlled is. So we'll count them all together. As to what we can do to canvas for a more equitable H-1B law, Mahindraji, you are on the phone. Why don't I do this? I'll leave you open, and one of the employers who have been concerned about this and feels that, like a lot of us do, that this bill is very, it's almost like throwing the H-1B program under the bus. They spoke to me briefly yesterday, and I wanted them to address all of you. So give me a minute or two. Maybe Mahindraji has some ideas that he has formed with other people, other employers that he's been speaking with. I'll leave you open for now, okay? Let me address the rest of the issues. Area code 732. Go ahead, please. 732, you had a question or a comment?
Yeah, Raj, this is a quick question, you know. As a H-1B dependent employee, if they have a more than 15% of H-1Bs, I mean more than 50%, if they don't have many H-1Bs, like more than 50% you said, right, out of 50, they have more than eight of the American workers. How does it work for extensions, Raj? I mean, if they have extension for 3+3 years, what happens in the extension case?
Okay, so the question is, all right, so we know what is going to happen when we do H-1B new file. Are we going to have similar problems and calculations when we do H-1 extension, correct?
Yeah.
And yes. The answer is probably. That is not covered, as far as I could tell, expressly, but implicitly, whenever you do an H-1 extension, transfer, or change of status, it's pretty much like doing a new H-1 all over again. I suspect the new law will apply if passed to all of these things. Okay.
We have to send them back to India, like their home country or something, like after the extension? How does it work?
No. Extensions will still be given within USA, but I think you'll be subject to the same rules as a new H-1 filing would be. For example, if you have more than 15% H-1B holders and you do an extension for somebody, you will be required to pay the higher fees and the higher salary, I think. I'm making a guess here.
Okay.
But if you're not H-1B dependent, and it should be like everybody else who's not H-1B dependent under the new law. So extensions, transfers, changes of status, all should be governed, amendments, all should be governed by the new laws if the new laws do get passed.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
My pleasure. Okay. Let's see. Area code 813. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Rajiv. Thank you for your time. The question I have is, when they're saying H-1Bs and the dependence on H-1Bs, are they even considering visas from, the Australia E3 visas, TN visas, and also what is their say on the OPTs, which is, ultimately going to be, converted to either an H-1 or, whether it is going to come for them, right? So was there a ruling passed on this, like how they are going to treat other visas and OPTs?
No, there is no calculation. Wherever I have seen, I've seen H-1B. But H-1B, I don't remember. Of course, Australian visas are E3, so they are not counted. I forgot what the designation of Chilean and Singapore visas. I think it's H-1B-1 something. I forgot what the designation is. But wherever I've seen just H-1B. So it does not look like they are considering Australian, Chilean, or Singaporean H-1s. And definitely they have not made any mention of OPTs. Okay. Couple of things I wanted to add before I forget. One thing, one program that we had put out, in fact, I contacted many of you for that, we a petition to the White House to reinstate the policy of visa revalidation. This bill has that. Now, I'm not saying that we made that happen. I mean, it's nice to see that it's there. The visa revalidation says this. If an employee has H-1B visa already on their passport and they want to do an extension of their H-1B visa, instead of going to the consulate, they can send their passport to Washington, D.C., and it will be stamped with an extended visa if appropriate by the State Department. This program used to exist a few years back, and then they discontinued it. It's a very good program because if you do visa revalidation within USA, an employee's trip outside USA, number one, becomes much more peaceful, and number two, it is a lot easier for business continuity to know that, you know, if I send an employee abroad, he's going to come back. Because right now, if you send somebody out, consulates could hold them for 1 month, 2 months, 8 months from a company that is a product manufacturing company for 2 years. What is the point of doing an H-1 after spending $7,000, $8,000? You can't have the employee back because the consulate thinks they should not be allowed back into USA. So visa reval is available. As far as your question about Australian visas, et cetera, are concerned, they are not counted. I didn't see any mention of that so far. Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Let me go on to the next question. Area code 732. Sunilji. Area code 732.
Yeah, Raju. Question is for the H-1B dependency, like the 50% of the employees needs to be on the specialty occupation, or there can be any employees like U.S. citizens with the clerical jobs or anything like that?
What the law says is this, that 15%, if you are 15% of your workforce is H-1B, you are H-1B dependent. The numbers are different for employees who are, I think, 26 or less, and then 26 to 50, those numbers are different. One is 8, the other one is 13, but then you get into 50 plus employees, one employee onwards, it's 15%. And they only look at the number of H-1Bs you have as compared to your total workforce. So if you have 100 clerical people and 15 H-1B employees, that's fine. Okay. There's no requirement that you must have professionals or H-1B comparable professionals working on the rest of the jobs.
Okay. Thanks, Raju.
You're welcome. Area code 630. Go ahead, please.
Yes, just wanted to ask again that if the employer is H-1B dependent and they're filing for an extension of a previously approved H-1B, but the employee whose extension has been filed, his or her I-140 is approved, still they would be going through all these hassles.
The way I see the law is this. The fact that a particular H-1B employee is an intending immigrant does not change requirements regarding that employee. His only contribution to your welfare is that he will not be counted towards your H-1B numbers. But if even without him your H-1B dependent, the fact that he is intending immigrant does not change anything in his filing. Make sense?
Okay.
All right, sir. Let me get on to the next one. Wow. Okay. Again, area code 630. 630.
I think that is the only question that I had.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Then we come to area code 408, my old and favorite friends. Go ahead, please.
Rajiv, when we count the total number of employees, the ones who have the I-140 approved are, we don't take them into account. But what happens to anyone who has appealed his I-140 when it's denied and, they have appealed? How will they be treated?
There is no mention of that. I-140 pending is what they have said. So if an appeal is pending, I would guess. The situation here is this. First, the bill has to pass. Then after the bill is passed, we will get regulations. And many of these things will be covered by regulation because there are some holes, like you pointed out. If it's under appeal, are they also an intending immigrant? And I would say, yes, they are. That would be my guess. Okay? But is that absolutely true? I do not know the answer to that question. The bill is not detailed enough to provide for that. You know, laws, bills are almost like a high-level design. They are a concept. And the idea is that the coding is done by USCIS, Department of Labor, State Department, CBP. They come in and fill in all the blanks. Okay. So right now, if you ask my guess, I would say an employee whose I-140 appeal is pending is still an intending immigrant. Okay. Do you have any other questions?
No, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Area code 973. Go ahead, please. 973. Go ahead, please. From Newark.
Mr. Khanna, the question is, so since the countrywide, it's proposed that the countrywide green card limitations might be removed, how fast do you expect the green card lines to move, and starting when do you expect to see a change for EB2 and EB3?
Yeah, that's my homework for next Friday. I have already started looking at more details. You are correct in saying that per country quota for employment-based immigrants will be removed. What does that mean? Let me elaborate on that for people who haven't thought this through. Right now, you have X thousand, I think number is 7,000 or something like that, employment-based visas allocated to each country. Whether it's a country of 1.3 billion people like Mother India or a country of only 850 people like Vatican City, you get the same number of visas. Okay? If you take all these visas and put them in one pot and everybody takes out of that, the numbers are going to become very, very fast.
Right.
As to when they are going to do it, I do not know. I think it begins in after 1 year of the enactment, somewhere in 2014, 2015, in that neighborhood. On top of that, they made other provisions. There are some very nice provisions in the law. If you have a STEM degree, master's or PhD, all you need is an employer saying, I want to hire you. You get your green card without a perm application. That's what it seems to be. There are other things in there. If your green card has been pending for X number of years, you can apply through point-based system. You can also apply through point-based system in certain other contingencies. So there's various ways you can get into it. Also, the entrepreneur program has been dropped down. Instead of putting in a million or 500,000, if you put in 250,000 and create 3 American jobs, you've got some immigration benefits coming to you. So there are a lot of different courses opening, not just the green card getting faster. So that's a very nice thing to see, that they have actually acknowledged that people who have waited legally for years and years, I mean, it's ridiculous. You have to wait 12, 13 years to get your green card if you have obeyed all the laws. Here's the painful part. Under the current scheme of immigration laws, if your perm has been filed as a systems analyst, you cannot be promoted to a project leader. If you are promoted to project leader, you've got to start all over again. Of course, you carry the priority date and all that. but it's additional expense. How many employers want to do that? So this whole system is very messed up. Part of it is it has become so anachronistic, out of time, because when the system was first started, labor certifications, the whole green card process used to take 6 months. Now it takes 10 years, 11 years, 12 years. So the system doesn't make sense longer. It hasn't made sense for years. I think that is being acknowledged. I also want to add one more thing since the word STEM came up. I was surprised to see that in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, which is STEM, when they are giving preference to STEM degrees, not all sciences are included, only physical sciences. And I've made a mention of that in the detailed video that I have done, which is on immigration.com already. If you see that video, it tells you in detail what degrees are included, what are not included. They are by Department of Education's zip codes. And by the way, STEM technology. The technology degrees are much vaster. I mean, a lot of things like data processing, even word processing are included in technology degrees. But you know, for whatever that is worth, remember, STEM does not contain all sciences. It contains only physical sciences, such as physics, I think chemistry, yeah, physics, chemistry, but not biology, none of the life sciences. Of course, physicians have some very, very good advantages as well. And people who've done PhDs in any discipline have advantages. Okay? So I think I went too far beyond your question, but I wanted to share that with all of you. So, yes, it will become a lot faster, and you will have a lot more opportunities. Employees will have a lot more opportunities. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
You're welcome. Yeah, call me Rajiv, please. My pleasure. All right, let's move on to the next question or comment. Another set of old friends from area code 262.
Hi, Rajiv. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thanks. The definition that you sent in your email indicated that an H-1B company cannot do a couple of things. One of the things you mentioned was outsourcing. So an H-1B dependent company cannot outsource. Is that in reference to an H-1B employee, or is that in reference to outsourcing like projects or administrative processes?
Okay. There is no restriction against outsourcing of projects. So I see a paradigm shift. Instead of saying, hey, look, I'll send my employees to work at your site, you'll say, give me the project, I'll handle it. If you own the project, that's not outsourcing. That's not outplacement. Okay? By the way, I'm not even sure Congress has used the right English word when they talk about outplacement. My understanding is outplacement is when an employee is being laid off and you try to outplace him to some other company. That's called outplacement. So, but for whatever reason, that's the phrase or that's the term they have used. To answer your question, if you own the project and you're doing it on your own premises, I don't think that's a problem at all.
If we own the project and we send the project to India to be performed and sent back, that was my
question. I don't see any problem at all.
Right.
Okay. So, companies, yeah, go ahead, please.
For H-1B dependent companies, when the law goes into effect, if you have H-1B employees assigned to third parties, will they be grandfathered in, or would you have to pull them out?
That's a very, very good question. And my guess is either they will not disturb existing scheme until you come to renewals, or they will give you a grace period, 12 months, 18 months, something like that. That's my guess.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, one thing I would like to see a study on is if we were to subtract all these high-tech workers from the U.S. workforce, how is the economy going to work there? I mean, I wonder how many hundreds of thousands of people are deployed working on projects, and all of a sudden you put this law into effect. It would be like bludgeoning a large part of the economy to death. But I don't know. I'm not an economist. Just from common sense perspective, I wonder how that would work out.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Okay. Let's see how many other questions or comments there are. It looks like we have one, and then we have, I hope that Mahinderji is here. He can talk to us about these matters. So two more questions or comments left. One is from area code 201. Go ahead, please. 201, go ahead. Jersey City, go ahead.
Hi, Rajiv. Question was, when would this definition of you being a dependent H-1B employer kick in? Would it be in effect when the law gets passed, or would it be for the immigration year October 2014 and beyond?
If Congress were to act in a reasonable way, it should be delayed at least one or two fiscal years. But, immigration laws of this country are not necessarily reasonable. And again, sometimes, to be fair, reasonable can be different from the viewpoint of the beholder. So my guess would be 1 to 2 years delay, but there is definitely some confusion in the law as it is written. There are some typos in the law as well. There is some confusion as to when these provisions kick in. It wasn't clear. At least I didn't think it was clear.
Sure. Because fiscal year of 2014 would still mean immigration year starting October 1st, 2013.
That is correct. Okay. We'll see. We'll see. Okay, going on to area code 919. Oh, my very favorite friends. How are you?
I'm amazed. How are you?
Reading and striving.
Well, our company is a consulting company, and if those numbers hold, then we could possibly be H-1 dependent. Did they consider contract companies and staffing companies when they did this? And we are IT staffing, so we are really severely affected by this.
The nature of your work is more than just staffing, because the software that you're working on is so extremely specialized, and there are so few people available to work on it. I mean, if you are running entire state governments on a particular software, then of course it's a highly specialized area, but they have made no provisions for that. What we will have to sit with you, and we'll have to work out a way where if you have to, then you can just take over the project instead of just sending in employees to work on projects that you are supervising. Just bring the project home or something like that. You'll have to work something out.
Okay.
But don't worry. I'm looking at other businesses like gas stations, etc. I know that that might end up happening. But I don't think it's that bad, because there are other ways provided in the law. There are things that we could think about, like even green cards, because green cards will become a lot faster. My guess would be a green card should eventually be less than a year start to finish if we go through this process. We could sit with your contract counsel, who, by the way, very, very smart. I liked her a lot. We can sit with somebody like her and draft contracts for you. That will make sure that we've got work continuity when we hire people and do their green cards.
Okay. Thank you.
By the way, who was telling me? Anna was saying, she says, your name, of course, she says she's a riot. I love talking to her. You are our favorite client, man.
I love you
all. Take care.
Right. Be good. Bye.
Bye.
Okay. We have a few more questions. Let's get into those as well. Mahendra, please stay on the line if you are here. I have one, two, three, four more comments, and then actually five more comments. Yeah, five more comments, and then we can get into this. Mahendra, let me get to you first. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi, Rajiv.
How are you, sir?
Good, sir. How are you?
Good. So you had questions, comments, words of wisdom?
No, because you had a doubt whether I'm here or not, so I raised my hand.
Yeah, good. No, I saw you. I'm glad. I'm going to leave you open so that when the time comes, I don't have to go looking for you. Just one second. Let me get to the next comment. And area code 201, Jersey City. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Rajiv.
201.
Hi, Rajiv. The question is, even if you are an H-1B dependent employer and hence you can't do outplacements, what if you are doing a project which involves the team working at the client site in its entirety?
Well, let me look at the definition of outplacement, okay? Give me a second. Let me tell you what their definition is. If I can... okay, let me do a search in the document for outplacement. I'm trying to remember what the definition is. It shall not place, outsource, lease, or otherwise contract for the services of placement. So shall not place, outsource, lease, or otherwise contract. It appears that if we maintain control over the employee, okay? Now, here's another interesting thing in this law. I'm not sure if you guys disagree with me. Because if you read the language, shall not place, outsource, lease, or otherwise contract for the services or placement of such, et cetera, et cetera. What if I'm not contracting about a particular employee, but I say, look, I'll provide you a workforce of qualified people, but I'm not contracting about a particular employee. Is that allowed? I don't think so, but it's something to think about. Shall not place, outsource, lease, or otherwise contract for the service. I'm not leasing. I'm doing the project. I'm controlling my employee. Is that allowed? It looks like it should be. So it looks like what they don't want is purely staffing business. Okay? So I don't know. It all depends upon what the final definitions come out to be. But there's definitely some room to argue there and some room to hope that things will not be as bad as we are worried that they might be.
Sure, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Raleigh, did you have another question?
No, I didn't have another question. I'm good. I'm listening.
Okay. Well, you have a good weekend, okay? All right, let's get back to, let's see, how many people? One more. This is from Pennsylvania. 570, go ahead, please, 570.
Hi. Basically, I wanted to understand about this, the proposal for the H-4 EAD, the reciprocity rule. There was another rule, that is the proposed law about H-4 EAD, the reciprocity rule. There was also a proposed rule somewhere around December or Jan from the Department of Homeland, which said that they would allow work permits for people, for H-1 holders who have, they would allow work permits for H-4s when the H-1 applicant has activated the AC-21 and is in the seventh year extension. So now, considering these two rules, would one take a precedence over the other, or it would really depend upon?
Absolutely. In the order of things, on top of the letter of laws is the U.S. Constitution. Anything that violates the Constitution, whether it's another law, a regulation, government action, or judicial action, even congressional action, if it's unconstitutional, it gets thrown out. Constitution on top, below that are laws made by Congress, below that are regulations. So what we are talking about is a regulation and a statute. When a law is made by Congress, it is much bigger than the regulation. The regulation will get thrown out. That regulation, by the way, is still pending before the Office of Management and Budget. It has not been passed. So, yeah, that regulation is still lying around. It's not been passed. I don't know what the future of that regulation is, but obviously, if the law passes, it trumps the regulation.
Okay. So, in case if this law gets passed first about the 7th year extension and then this proposed rule by Congress is passed, then the proposed rule would take up precedence and this law would be quashed, right?
If the proposed law passes, the regulation that is coming out of USCIS will get quashed.
Right.
You're right. And if it does pass, until the new law passes, that regulation will govern the law of H-4 work authorization.
Okay. And I had a second question. The other question was, does the proposed bill, does it have any provisions for allowing people who for whom I-140 has been approved, and if instead of waiting for 5-10 years before their priority date becomes current and applying for 485 and then getting the work authorization, is there any proposal for those applicants for whom the I-140 has been approved to also apply for or submit the I-485 and parallelly get a work permit pending decision?
So your question is it possible to get EAD at the I-140 stage instead of the I-485 stage?
Yeah, I mean, currently after 140, if you're EB2, you have to wait for 4-5 years, and if you're EB3, you have to wait for maybe 8-10 years before you can actually file your 485, and 6 months from then you can get your EAD. So now, instead of waiting for that 5-10 years, since the priority date is not current, is there a provision to allow applicants to file their 485, and within 6 months from that filing, get the work permit and not have to wait for 8-10 years, something similar to what was done in 2007?
There is no such rule. In fact, there never was any rule about EAD issuance at the I-140 stage. And by the way, EAD issuance takes about 90 days. I have not seen any such provision in this law.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome. Okay. Now, I think we are pretty much done with all the questions. Now, let me come back to the issue that was started I believe it was area code 972. Manoj, why don't you take over? Why don't you let us know what you folks are thinking?
Hey, Rajaji, thank you. First of all, I appreciate what you are doing. Every time some issue has been there, you have been in the forefront of all the attorneys coming and educating the community, not only the employees and family-based everything. So that is very highly appreciated. What we are trying to see is, we have been reactive all these years. Every time something happens and after the law passes, we look at it and we try to work around and see how best we can do. The greatest example is the Newfield memo. But at least now we kind of have an opportunity to be proactive, because this is a very, very initial stage and we have so much knowledge about this bill. And what we can do, and the two things need to be done, is one is to educate the lawmakers about how we do businesses and how the economy evolved based on this IT staffing industry, how the jobs were kept in the United States, and how much we are contributing towards the U.S. economy by businesses like us, both economically and technologically. Second thing, also biggest thing, is to educate ourselves also, all our companies, where do we stand and what we should do. and how we do it. So we are thinking of forming a coalition of experts, obviously somebody like you and some other experts in the industry, along with some of the CEOs of these companies, put together like a coalition team and start working on several fronts. Like the biggest thing you have been advocating as for almost like 6-7 years now, to do a big PR, a good PR about our businesses, about a PR and having our own lobbying presence in Washington, D.C., who can fully represent our company's interests. And also, I like the great idea, what you said yesterday, to constitute somebody like an institution or a respected individual from Harvard or somewhere to constitute a study in 30 days. What are the, you know, what is the impact if this bill goes and how it is going to affect the industry, economy, businesses, and livelihoods? And take that as a weapon and arm with it and go and educate the lawmakers. So this is our plans, and trying to see if we can put together all this and bring the companies together. Of course, all this requires a lot of understanding, cooperation, and finance. So the plan is in place, high level, and we are talking to a few folks, and we want all the companies to come together and work on this. And specifically for this 972, that is from Dallas, that person, I'm not sure whether he's already in touch, but if not, he can touch with some of the folks there already. They are leading it. Like yesterday we had Satish, he's from Dallas. So he can contact and then work with them. And all the companies here, surely we don't know the names and all, but you can always send an email to Rajiv G, and Rajiv G can in turn forward to us, or we can put together a coalition team.
Sure. My email is very easy to remember. Just send an email to, this is my personal email, help@immigration.com. help@immigration.com. That's my personal email. Feel free to drop me an email if you want me to forward it to Mahinder G. If they do end up doing something, you know, I think a lot of the companies who are in outsourcing, not necessarily outsourcing, consulting work, have taken a big beating on the public relations front, because everybody, typical profile of a technology company, consulting company, is not thousands of people. These are smaller companies. So everybody has pretty much gone about doing their own business and not gotten together and created an image which is truer to where people stand. I mean, one of our clients, some of these clients that I've worked with for 15 plus years, they are very good people. They have tried their very best to obey the laws. The laws are so confusing, so uncertain, and nobody has ever raised a voice against that simply because we don't have a united front. Mahinderji and I were talking yesterday. I said, you know, we are day laborers. All we do is come, do our work, get paid, go home, eat and sleep. That's the nature of everybody's business. So we need an organization, maybe 4, 5, 10 people, whose job it is to almost full-time look after the interest of making the representation more balanced. Right now, whatever the naysayers say, that's what Congress believes. I mean, this problem of non-participation exists even at congressional level. On the House side, the buzz is that the two congressmen whose names I mentioned, Goodlatte and Gowdy, they try to organize meetings and get congressmen involved, and they said the participation was very poor. They're trying to teach people about immigration law. Nobody wants to learn. So I think it's a good idea, Mahinderji, to put together some kind of a study. That's the right thing to do. But feel free to write to me. I'll be happy to forward the questions.
We'll try to have another call next week based on how these are going, Rajiv, along with you. Probably we can do that call as like a – now we have an education call today. Probably we can have like a strategy call, and let us see. We'll figure it out. But, folks, just send an email to help@immigration.com, and then we'll contact you. Talking to like people in Dallas, people in Atlanta, people in Virginia, in Chicago, you know, try to see like if we can bring together and, as Rajiv said, like get like 2-3 people, hire them and work them for us, and put them in the front end, and then let them, you know, we'll employ them to have our work done. That's a basic idea. So we can discuss it more when we all come together.
Sounds good. Mahindraji, do you have any comments? Any other comments? Anybody has any comments, concerns, questions? Press 5-star. I've got one person. Illinois, go ahead, please.
Just one final question. Could you please repeat the numbers for dependency calculation? It's going to be 50 or more, 15%, and 100 or more, 30%? What is the calculation?
No. After 50, it's 15%. Once you hit the number 51, it's 50%. 15%. Okay? Below that, and I'm speaking from memory here, I could be wrong, somewhat like this. If it's between 26 and 50, the number is 13. That's when you become H1 dependent. If it is less than 26, I think the number is 8.
Okay. Yes, that is right, Rajiv. You can have up to 7 employees if you are under 25. And 26
right.
to 50, you can have up to 12 employees.
Right. Thank you. Thank you. I'm 50 plus, everybody who's 50 plus, 15%. 15% makes you H1B dependent.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm really bad with numbers. Unless you put a dollar sign in front, then I'm okay. All right. Let's see. Last call, guys. Anybody has any questions of any kind, any comments? I think we are done here. Oh, yeah. I think we are done. Oh, one question, one comment. Mahesh, go ahead, please.
Yeah, just I want to reconfirm that, Rajiv, the numbers, what you said for the dependency calculations, people who file their labor for more than a year pending R-140 approved, they're exempt from the counting towards the dependency. But just want to make sure that, you know, they are counted as the U.S. citizens or green card holders, right? It's basically they are exempt, means just exempted from counting H-1, or are they counted on the other 85% of that?
No, they're not counted as other 85% as far as I know. They just become neutralized.
Oh, okay. So because everybody's under impression that, you know, they are counted towards that the other 85%, because that's what I wanted to reconfirm on that.
I don't believe so, but if I, as I'm reading the act further, if I think it's different, I'll put it on our web page. I'll let you know if, you know, the other day we were discussing this and this is what I found out. But in my view, what they are talking about is that just these people would not be counted. If you want, I can double check that real quickly. Give me one second.
If you could, yeah, that's the main thing, because it's totally, that makes the difference.
It says very clearly, in determining the number of employees who are H-1B non-immigrants, an intending immigrant employee shall not count towards such number. That's the only thing. So in other words, they don't count to plus you, they just negate the negative.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I just confirmed that. That's what the law says.
Thank you, Rajiv.
Okay. My pleasure. There's one or two comments left. Let me just double check. Last call, guys. Press star 5 if you have any question or comment. Star 5. There's one. Oh, my God. Long time no hear. 732, go ahead, please.
Hi, Rajiv. I have a hypothetical question, which if I have, say, 100 H1 employees in my company, and all the 100 H1 employees, I file the GC, green card, on permanent residency,
right,
then I do not come in the H1 dependency issue. And if I pay $500 and do an outplacement, and I have a good employee-employer relationship, then this new law should not affect me at all. Is that correct? Is my understanding correct?
That is correct. As long as that's what the new law seems to say, as long as you've got a green card, intended immigrants as defined, who are 85 or 86 out of the 100, then you fall below the 15%, and now you can outplace them.
Thank you, Rajiv.
You're welcome. Okay. Very good, guys. I think we are done here. I appreciate your time, everybody, and talk with all of you soon.